I do believe the tape is rolling.
Excellent. Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and this is Crave, the podcast about films, music, television, anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe over the last week or so. And Steve, it's rather appropriate that this is the seventh episode of Crave.
Indeed, the 007th episode of Crave. Never one to be caught out by the Millennium Bug. I've been saving files on my computer with three digits, and so I'm actually looking at files and say Crave 007. It's almost as though when we conceived of this thing of ours, we set it up this way. That's how good we are.
It's just like magic.
It is. It's uncanny, isn't it?
So, yes, and obviously we're talking about Bond, James Bond.
What else can we talk about this week? What else can we talk about? Well, actually, it's quite a few things, to be honest.
Yes. So apart from Daniel Craig's fourth outing as James Bond, this is the film called Spectre. Steve, you've sampled a movie genre that, excuse the pun, never dies, the zombie film.
Absolutely. We've also caught up with the one flying visit, a very quick visit to Auckland, of rising young, how are we going to describe him? Blues, rock, very dark but very powerful, wonderful singer, Hozier, or Hozier, depending on who you ask.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I suppose which part of the world you're from, Hozier. That's well worth talking about. And Steve showing what a dedicated reviewer he is of entertainment. He also, this week, joined the crowd to see Robbie Williams, no less.
And there's more to talk about reviewing Robbie Williams than actually seeing him, to be fair.
Yes, I look forward to that. But anyway, that's that.
Well, we'll start, obviously, with 007 this week. We'll start off with James Bond. Skyfall, let's be fair, was always going to be a very, very tough act to follow. It was, at the time, I'm going to say the best Bond film to date. It was the 50th anniversary. They let everything go. They threw everything at that film. And I thought it was utterly, utterly brilliant. So how on earth does one follow that?
Yes, I know. And I think the answer is you follow it by making Spectre, the latest film, part of the same story, isn't it? It's actually the same director, it's the same characters, and they've carried on the story. If you remember, at the end of Skyfall, M, as played by Judi Dench, has died. Bond is now working with a new M, played by Ralph Fiennes. We've got some new characters like Moneypenny re-established and so forth, and we found out about all the through Daniel Craig's films as Bond, there's been a bit of a thread running through some characters who pop back in, and that continues. So it's almost like another chapter of the same story, isn't it? I mean, if you could almost go back to Casino Royale, his first film, and say this is the fourth chapter of that story.
There is a degree of truth in that, and yet what they've done quite brilliantly is they've made a standalone film which doesn't need to be seen as part of a quaternity. Is that the word now? A quadrilogy. There you go.
Quadrilogy, yep, that'll do.
It doesn't have to be seen within that sequence. However, if you do, you'll see a much richer film experience. So shall we just recap the story very, very briefly? Now, remember, Simon, no spoilers.
Yes, this is a challenge for this review.
Isn't it just?
But let's just say that to go back to the end of Skyfall, which hopefully you've seen, Judi Dench as M dies, and there's something about her legacy that sets the ball rolling for this next film, and we see Bond again, as no surprise to say, he's all over the world chasing down leads about sorry, Steve, I'm just thinking anything I say here, I've got to be careful.
we do. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Yes.
It is the tricky.
Basically, he's looking to avenge M's death to a degree. He's looking to figure out what led to the events at the end of Skyfall.
He absolutely is, yes. And it's done in a way which is that combination of action, thriller, but some mystery, and a multi-layered approach to the storytelling, which, as you say, Steve, it brings in references to what's happened before, which, if you have seen the previous films, will really hit home, and just takes you through in a clever but not over-complicated story, a story you can follow but is interesting, through to a really wonderfully constructed and crafted film, I think.
Well, I think rather than dwelling on the intricacies of the plot, which will lead us down potential spoiler alleys, and we want to avoid that
yes.
as far as possible, let's focus on what's going on in the film, because we do have a complex, an intricate plot, as you always do in a Bond film, but it's not as incoherently complicated as, say, Quantum of Solace, which notoriously nobody can actually explain what the hell that film was about.
So, I still can't.
No, nobody can. Nobody can. I'm sure if you ask Daniel Craig or Sam Mendes, they would probably struggle to give you a simple answer to what that film was about. So we do have a fairly straightforward, although deftly constructed, plot. I think what's more interesting is the character developments that we see in Spectre.
Absolutely. Now, we've re-established a new Q and a new M, of course, Ben Wishart and Ralph Fiennes, and they actually have some really fantastic scenes, well-scripted scenes, which are both at times dramatic and comedic as well.
Well, in the past, they've often struggled with what exactly to do with Q. Historically, he was always played by Desmond Llewellyn, and he was this slightly eccentric professor who pulled out these ridiculous and absurd toys that were quite entertaining, but they were always going to be the deus ex machina that pulled James out of another hole at the end of the film. And he was played wonderfully by Desmond Llewellyn, who would fluster in and, "Oh, for heaven's sake, 007, and that's all we ever really got from him, to be honest. When he died, and they were left without an actor to play Q, they famously roped in John Cleese for Die Another Day. And that, I mean, I am a huge John Cleese fan, but that told me that this character was suddenly scrambling and struggling for direction. They'd lost track of what to do with him. They even let go of Q for Casino Royale and for Quantum of Solace. Q doesn't appear in those two films. But they brought him back when Ben Whishaw was enlisted to play Q in Skyfall, and suddenly we had a character, rather than simply some bloke who pulls out a toy and then buggers off, you've got somebody who is now a character who is fleshed out, who is fantastically played. He's well written, but he's brilliantly performed by Wishaw, who brings geek passion to the character in a wonderful way.
Geek passion, yeah.
In fact, some of the very best scenes in the film didn't even feature Daniel Craig, but was simply between Ralph Fiennes playing M and Wishaw, who M refers to as my quartermaster.
Yeah, it's a lovely reference. And I kind of felt like you really had a sense of this is Bond's team.
Yes.
You know, he's out there in the field doing his thing, but he's actually got people like M, like Q, and Moneypenny too, for that matter.
Yes.
Proper characters involved in the story in a significant way. In fact, they're very important in driving the story along. And Ralph Fiennes, I thought you got the sense, as you did in Skyfall, that this is a bloke who also knows what it's like to be out in the field
yes.
and to be confronting danger. And he's got a very nicely scripted sequence there where he lays all that out. So, yeah, that worked really, really well. We also have, of course, another villain.
Yes.
Now, if you've seen the trailer, we're not going to say too much about the exact identity of this villain, but there's a wonderful actor playing him, Christoph Waltz, who's got a wonderful track record and the Oscars to prove it, and brings a sort of enigmatic, cool, evil persona to the role, and it's a really nice touch.
It is. It's quite beautiful. The temptation must have been there to chew all the scenery he could find, and he doesn't. It's understated without being disappointing, I think, to be honest. He could have gone all out, full on Bond villain, and it would have been entertaining, but it wouldn't have had the richness and the depth that he brought to it. I was very, very impressed.
Yeah.
As people have remarked, you should never trust a man who doesn't wear socks with his shoes.
No, how could you? We should mention briefly the role of the Bond women, Steve.
Yes.
A lot was made of the fact that there was Monica Bellucci in this film, a glamorous European actress, a little older than perhaps the traditional Bond woman.
And yet, as Craig famously pointed out in an interview, when he was asked, Bond finally sleeps with an older woman, he says, no, he slept with a woman of his own age.
That was a classy scene in the film. I won't say any more than that, but I thought they treated that very, very nicely.
Indeed.
And the other main female character is, without giving too much away, she's a foil to a certain extent, and also very much involved in the actual plot.
Yes, this is Lea Seydoux playing Madeleine Swann. To be fair, Bond girls, as they are rather dismissively referred to usually, tend to be foils for Bond to play off. But she was increasingly, a as they say these days, a character with agency.
Ah, yes, yes.
As indeed, and you've hinted at her, I think she deserves a lot more reference than you're giving her. Naomi Harris playing Moneypenny, finally gets out from behind the desk.
That's right. Yes, we do. You're quite right. She's away from the office, and it's an opportunity to give these other characters a real identity and a sense of they're real people. They're not just not a case of seeing them only in one environment, and that just gives the film a bit more of a satisfying feel to it.
It does.
And of course, we should just mention Mr. Craig. I couldn't help but notice, Steve, there was a lot said in the lead up to the release of this film of some of his media conferences and a famous remark, or infamous, that he'd had enough of it and he was going to walk away from it. And so despite myself, I wondered occasionally as I was looking at the film, is this a guy is he going through the motions, or is he really, has he bought into it yet again? I'm just interested to know what you thought about that. How did you feel he carried it off for the fourth time?
I am still of the impression, and this from a British Bond fan is borderline heresy, I am increasingly of the opinion that he's the best Bond to date. Partly it's the quality of the films, but I'm thinking he even beat Sean Connery. And that's hard to say, but I'm thinking he is actually that good. And no, there wasn't the slightest hint of Craig phoning it in. The man has brought subtlety to the character that I don't think has ever existed before. He's referred to throughout the film not as a spy, he's an assassin. He refers to himself at one point as a killer, not as a spy, not as a secret agent. He's an assassin. In many ways, Craig plays him as something of a cipher, but behind what's largely a very craggy and very blank face, you do see hints of depth and vulnerability and complexity in the character. There's a couple of scenes, and these are not spoilers. I'm not giving anything away because this is in the trailer, so we're allowed to talk about these. A scene where, toward the beginning of the film, where he collapses a building, and the look on his face tells you, that's not what I meant to do. You don't often get an oops from James Bond, but that was one of them. There's another scene, again, in the trailer, where he's chasing the bad guys in a plane. And he looks scared. He has a look on his face that says, I don't actually know if this is going to work out or not. He gives a vulnerability to Bond that I don't think we've ever really seen before. So no, I don't think it's fair to say that there was any doubt in his mind. I can imagine this was a hard film to make. He apparently had surgery on his knee from an injury he got during one of the fight scenes. So yeah, this was a punishing film. It's got to be a demanding role.
Yeah.
But no, I have no qualms about saying that he performed this fantastically. He is Bond.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point to make. You know, this type of film, the Sam Mendes films, all the Craig films, they're light years away from that campy comic book approach, Roger Moore, even Pierce Brosnan to a certain extent. This is a realistic attempt to depict what a James Bond story is all about. And you've got superb direction, the production values, the quality of acting, a clever script.
Yes.
And one thing I was wondering as we were moving through this is, where do they take it from here? You know, we're just teasing out a little bit of his backstory that we started in Skyfall, his family history, an element of that carries on. It's important to the story. It's going to be fascinating to see if Sam Mendes, this is his last film, how you advance this and where you take it. But, I've got no hesitation in recommending it. Even if you're not a big Bond fan, this is a genuinely good thriller adventure story that I think you'd enjoy.
Well, speaking of where you go next, and I have to be very, very careful here to avoid huge spoilers, because I'm going to make a reference to the end of the film. And I felt that at the end of the film, if the producers so choose, and I very much doubt they will, there's far too much money involved in this, but if they were so moved, they could end it here. They could say, that's it. There weren't the loose ends hanging around that scream, please, please make a sequel. There was nothing that has to be done. It was very neatly tied up. And the number of callbacks to earlier films, very explicit references to other films, made you wonder if this was almost a tribute to the preceding films in the series, as though they were tying it up. I mean, we can call out thousands. There was one wonderful scene when they're in the middle of the desert and a car's sent to pick them up, Bond and Madeleine Swann. And Bond very explicitly identifies the car as a Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith.
Right.
He didn't. There was no need for him to specifically name the make and model of the car, except that it made it very easy for me to confirm that that was indeed exactly the same car that featured in From Russia with Love.
Okay. And I think, and we won't say give it away too much else like that, but if you are familiar with the Bond films going way back, there'll be other scenes in this film which will just ring a little bell with you and think, oh, I remember that. That was similar to this film or that film. That's very cleverly interwoven
there
into the screenplay.
Countless moments. Yeah. The opening sequence, which is in the Day of the Dead festival in Mexico City, it, although not directly related, immediately calls to mind the opening to, for my money, possibly the worst Bond film ever, Live and Let Die. There's a sequence in a rather odd-looking building at the top of an Alp somewhere with a cable car going up, which again brings to mind On Her Majesty's Secret Service. You've got a shooting gallery scene that comes out of The Man with the Golden Gun. They go on and on and on. I mean, there must have been thousands I missed, I'm sure. We're going to see this again, aren't we?
I think we are. I think this is one of those sort of films I would say there's so much involved here, I'd actually quite like to see it again and see what I missed the first time.
I'm thinking there's a lot that we missed, and I would be delighted to see it. The one criticism I had of Skyfall was that the big, I think we can call it a battle sequence at the end,
yeah,
where the battle for Skyfall House, whatever you want to call it, that huge scene at the end, for my money was about 15 minutes too long.
Okay.
I didn't think that it drove the story forward because, I mean, I know it's a big climactic scene. You have to have explosions and henchmen falling off gantries and stuff like that. But it was overlong for my money. But I do remember at the end of Spectre thinking, that was 2.5 hours?
Yeah, no, it was fantastic. So a couple of ticks from Mr. McCabe and I on that one. Now, with this actually, Steve... by the way, this is Crave. This is Steve McCabe and Simon Mercier's podcast, our regular look at films and TV and music. One more film, Steve, to consider this week. Not one I saw myself, but golly, with a title like this, you can imagine how heartbroken I was that I didn't get to see.
Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Really?
Yeah, seriously. my... I don't know. Where do you
what
go?
Can you say about
Well, the fact that they can't even spell the title properly was not a good sign. There's no apostrophe in Scouts.
Right.
That right there rings warning bells. That did not set it up well. So, yeah, let's face it. We're going to talk a little bit later about journalistic ethics, and we'll bring it up right now. Never prejudge a film.
Yeah, true.
It was utter nonsense. It really was. With a title like that, what else could it possibly be? Do I really need to even give you an outline of the story? I think you can probably figure out what the plot's going to be from the title, Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. There's a zombie apocalypse. The heroes who fight the zombies, guess who they are? You'll never guess. Go on, have a go.
The Scouts!
Oh, you've seen it, clearly. Yeah, it's absolute nonsense. But what makes a film like this work is never going to be the story, because it's utterly preposterous, as any film will always be that's based around scouts and zombies. You're on dangerous ground making a zombie comedy after films like Shaun of the Dead or Zombieland, which were both utterly brilliant.
Yeah, they were good.
So this is a dodgy genre to start venturing into, and I went out of a sense of duty to our listeners, because that's the kind of consummate professional that I am, and you're clearly not. But I went anyway.
It was my commitment.
Yeah. You'll go and see James Bond, but you'll draw the line at the zombies. Fair enough. We'll see where you stand, Mercep.
So I have the appetite for it.
So I took one for the team.
Yeah.
And I went along. And when I came out of it 90 minutes later, I thought, well, that was an awful lot better than it had any business being.
No.
Yeah, seriously.
Really? Okay.
It was surprisingly entertaining. Like I said, you don't go to these films for the story. You go for the laughs.
Yeah.
And it was a surprisingly deftly made film. There was a lot of detail in it, an awful lot of very, very finely crafted gross-out comedy. I'm not going to give anything away because, yeah, it's not consistently hilarious. There are moments where you will laugh very, very hard. There are moments when you will say, no, please don't ever do that again. And I'll let you figure out for yourselves which bit those are. There are three central characters, three scouts, played by Ty Sheridan, Logan Miller, and Joey Morgan, three actors I'd never heard of before, and quite frankly, I'm not really convinced I'm going to be hearing a whole lot more of again. But they turned in decent performances.
Yeah,
the film is more sympathetic to scouts than you might imagine. the scout leader is a very, very sad middle-aged man with a wig and a Dolly Parton fixation. And again, the fact that he has this Dolly Parton obsession is a little detail that doesn't need to be there, but just fleshes out the character a little bit, makes it a film that's got attention to detail, and that's what makes it entertaining. But one of the real stars of the film, or at least one of the stars of the story in particular, is Sarah Diamante's Denise, not a stripper, just a cocktail waitress. She points that out very, very clearly.
Right.
And although you'd never expect to read this film as a feminist tract, it does actually play the dumb blonde as an intelligent and sympathetic character who has more strength and agency than the scouts do. So it's actually quite intelligently done. It's a toss-away film, it really is. But it's a lot better than really it ought to be. Now, the fact that it's opening opposite a film like Spectre in New Zealand shows that people don't have enormously high expectations of it. But it's highly entertaining, diverting, fun. Nothing profound, nothing significant. Trust me, it's not going to pass the Bechdel test, but no. It will entertain you quite pleasantly for an hour and a half, and then you'll probably forget about it.
Okay, so I think you might actually suggest I purchase a ticket and check this out on a wet afternoon or something.
For a wet afternoon, go on a Tuesday when the tickets are cheap at your local cinema. There's worse ways of spending an afternoon. There are better ones, I'll be the first to admit it, but there's definitely worse ones too.
All right, thanks. Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. What a title.
Absolutely.
This is Crave. Now, Steve, we should turn our attention to music.
Indeed.
Checked out an Irish musician who, gosh, he drew a pretty decent-sized crowd to Auckland's Victor Arena this week. And I guess that was, pretty much on the basis of what has been a very well-received debut album from him, right?
Indeed, this is Andrew Hosier-Byrne, who goes by Hosier on stage. He's got one album out, self-titled.
Yep.
He's got one big hit single from it, Take Me to Church. And on the strength of that, I was astonished that he was even booked into Vector Arena. And when we got there, I was concerned that they grossly oversold him. I don't think I've ever seen the Vector Arena that full.
It was, yeah. And you have to say, he absolutely had that crowd, the full crowd. They were with him for every time he said, thank you very much.
Well, it's the Irish charm.
It is. Yeah, he had a lot of young fans, and a few who weren't so young. A young man, he's only in his mid-20s, I think, Steve.
He is.
This is a tour. He's obviously zipping around Australasia. He was like literally one day in New Zealand. But he had people lapping it up. A great show. I hadn't really heard that first album. I really enjoyed it. I thought this is a guy who has got a lot of presence on stage, a warmth, but a certain a genuineness that people could see and relate to, a great band. And the most interesting thing I found was that the music is, this isn't light pop, it's a lot of relationship songs, but it's not, this is nothing like, I don't know, Take Five or One Direction or anything like that. This is serious, considered songwriting. Heavy music at times, quite blues oriented at times, and the young people really bought into it.
Very much so. He's got two big hits out at the moment, Take Me to Church and Someone New. And Someone New in particular is a very light, very poppy, very bounce along song. It's a lovely, lovely piece of music.
Yeah.
But I kind of got the feeling that a lot of his audience were there to hear songs like that. And so when he starts playing songs like To Be Alone, which is a vicious, nasty piece of blues rock that he tore into with the most phenomenal passion and aggression. It was an amazing performance. And I think some of his audience were possibly thinking, hang on, this isn't what we came here for. But if they were thinking that, they must also have been thinking, but by God, it's good. I was very, very impressed. I mean, the one of his album tracks called Jackie and Wilson, which again is a reasonable rocker and fairly frothy song on the album, I barely recognised it. It had an intensity in his live performance that blew me away. I was extraordinarily impressed. Part of what made a difference, I have to confess, a little disappointed with his opening act, Rhodes, which was one man and one guitar in front of one microphone on a very large stage. And I think, as you remarked to me at one point, I quite agree, there's not really a whole lot you can do with that. There's a limit to the number of places you can take that kind of setup. But Hozier, along with himself, standing alone in front of a microphone on a what looked like a rather nice Persian rug on the stage, he had a six-piece band,
including
a cellist.
Yes, a good band, good backing singers. Again, a band, the same thing has happened when we saw Avalanche City the other week, musicians who were multi-talented, who would swap over instruments. It was a great sound. And I just want to come back briefly, Steve, to the element of how he's, what he's writing about and the way he puts it.
Yes.
A lot of relationship songs. Often with concerts, live concerts, depending on where you're sitting, if you're not familiar with the song, sometimes it's not always that easy to pick up all the lyrics.
Right.
And there was one song he sang, In a Week.
Oh, what a lovely song that is.
Yeah, and there were some references there to corpses and things. And I actually afterwards went out to check the lyrics to just see exactly what I'd missed. And here's part of the song. We lay here for years or for hours, thrown here or found to freeze or to thaw. So long we'd become the flowers. Two corpses we were, two corpses I saw. And they'd find us in a week when the weather gets hot, after the insects have made their claim. I'd be home with you, I'd be home with you.
After the foxes have known our taste.
Yeah, that is not I Want to Hold Your Hand.
No, forever. It is beautiful. And it's worth mentioning that on the album, he sings it as a duet with a woman named Karen Cowley, who's one of his backing singers on the show. And the two of them performed it with the most astonishing magnificence and beauty.
Yeah, very impressive. And a couple of covers, which also were really nice. The Beatles, no less. Blackbird.
Indeed.
No, Bluebird. Blackbird. Blackbird. What am I saying? Bluebird. Blackbird. And that was a lovely rendition of it.
And are you an Ariana Grande, my daughter will shoot me for that, fan at all, Simon?
No, I wasn't. I know the song you're referring to. When I heard this song, I actually thought, I was thinking it's sort of a soul, sort of a feel. My mind went to way back to the 80s to... and it's gone out of my head, Steve.
Well, the name that you turned to me with,
yes,
was Hall & Oates.
Hall & Oates, that's right. I was going to say there was a Hall & Oates feel about that song to me, but it wasn't Hall & Oates.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I'm not familiar, but I was with you. I was thinking this is a very 80s reading of whatever song it is. Apparently, it's Problem by Ariana Grande.
Okay.
And that comes to you courtesy of Google, because I wouldn't have known it. But it was a good song. I mean, the man has a great ear for a really catchy tune, and obviously he knows other people's. He did say that this is being performed just for fun. He was almost apologetic about it, which really wasn't necessary.
And he said all the right things in between the songs. They loved it. And look, if he's back, I would really recommend you catch him next time.
Oh, absolutely, wouldn't you? Just one filling out Vector Arena on the strength of one album is risky, I think, to be perfectly honest. I'd say he pulled it off, and I would without doubt chase down a ticket for him next time.
Than any stranger I choose. Things
move. Mr. McKay barely paused for breath this week. You squeezed in another show. This is with a concert from a man who, now this guy has been around for a bit. He's got a big rep. Robbie Williams, no less.
Absolutely. Robbie Williams played Vector Arena two nights before. Hozier did. Played on the Tuesday night of last week. And now, so we're not going to go into too much detail other than to mention the fact that, yeah, the man is a superb performer. The music, to be honest, left me a little bit cold, but I can see why people enjoy his show. He's a phenomenal showman. He really, really is. But it's worth mentioning that I got tickets from the promoter, as I often do. We've seen so far this week, we've discussed Skyfall, Hozier, we've talked about the Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, and we've mentioned Robbie Williams. Now, if I'd actually paid for tickets for all of those, I'd be, by the time everything's added up, including guests, I'd be over $1,000 out of pocket.
Yeah.
And that simply isn't sustainable. So just like most film and music review magazines, websites, podcasts, we're not paying for our tickets because we can't. We get our tickets from promoters, from distributors, from publicists. And that's as it should be, because otherwise there's no way we could do this.
Yeah, and the question is, to what extent does that make us beholden to that promoter to paint a rosy picture? And the answer is, well, actually, it doesn't make us beholden.
No. You can smell a fake review a mile off.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. They wouldn't want us to be anything other than honest. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't give our listeners a basic rundown of what's involved, a few facts, so they can get their head around what to expect. But beyond that, this is what we think of it. And actually, that came up in the Robbie Williams, his visit, didn't it? He had a particular point or two to make about a certain review he'd been on the receiving end of.
Indeed, there was obviously a context to this little conversation. Williams played the Basin Arena, I believe it's called, in Wellington.
Oh, the Basin Reserve?
Basin Reserve, that's the one. In Wellington, the weekend before he came up to Auckland, and Simon Sweetman for Stuff wrote a review which ripped into Williams quite brutally. Now, some of it had some very, very tart and very well-written lines. I'm thinking, wow, I'd like to be able to write like that. You know, he made reference to the fact that the Williams' fame shows how far you can take karaoke if you've got the cheekbones. Now, that's a lovely, tart little line. But the problem is, you got the impression that much of this review had been written before Sweetman even arrived at the venue.
Right.
And that's not right.
No. So you can be assured that on Crave we don't phone it in.
Nah, well, actually, you quite literally do, Simon.
That's only because we geographically we're in different parts of the Auckland region.
This is true.
That's correct. Yes.
But metaphorically, no, we absolutely don't. You've got to be honest about a show. I mean, I wasn't expecting an enormous amount out of Robbie Williams. I didn't personally get a huge amount out of it, although I could see the people around me were lapping it up. I took a friend who's been a lifelong fan. She told me on the way home that her bucket list was complete now. That was one of the greatest days of her life, and I thought, I'm very glad I could give that to you. And she enjoyed it enormously. I could see the man knew what he was doing on stage. He's a consummate performer. And so if I were to be doing a full review, I would be mentioning points like that. But no, it's not really my thing. And in fact, I was offered review tickets to see Fat Freddy's Drop about 2 weeks ago, and I had to decline them because I didn't think I would be able to give a fair review. That's not my kind of music. I'm not going to enjoy the show. So there's no sense sending me to a show that I'm going to review with the words, "Yeah, that wasn't very good, was it?"
Yeah,
that's not appropriate.
Yep. All good. Okay, Steve. I think that's a very useful bit of information to just get out there so everyone's very clear. Yes, we do get the opportunity to see entertainment we may not otherwise see just because of the cost to us, but we're just giving some honest opinions, and you make of it what you will. Yeah. Pretty much run out of time this week. We've had a pretty busy week, haven't we?
Well, I certainly have, yes.
You have, particularly. Now, next time, we've got a few things on the agenda.
We have indeed. I'm off to see 10cc in Auckland.
You like cricket?
I love it.
Excellent. God, you know, that's a name from my past. It's the 70s they were doing their thing, wasn't it, Steve?
They were. From my hometown, actually, they're from Stockport. I'm quite looking forward to that one. I'll be as honest as I can. I'm looking forward to it, but I have a feeling it could be a bit creaky. They must be in their 60s and 70s by now, but we'll see how well they pull it off.
Lovely, lovely. Okay, so, and a few other things besides next time on Crave. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter at the very creatively selected Twitter handle @CravePodcast.
Ah, wonderful work there. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.